This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Every week, speaker, consultant Mark AmTower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. AmTower Off-Center with your host, Mark AmTower.
Welcome to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest today has several former titles. Warren Master is a former senior executive with the federal government, the former president and editor-in-chief of one of my favorite publications, Public Manager, and currently is at ASPA as the, is it just the editor of Good Governance Worldwide, Warren? How does that go?
Yeah, I'm the managing editor of Good Governance Worldwide, which is an online journal and professional networking.
Cool. Well, first of all, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Mark, always.
And, you know, it's been a while since we've had a chat. Warren and I first met, late 80s, maybe early 90s, when you were running a program at GSA. And everybody, you know, right now thinks shared services is a new and really cool concept. When we met, you were running the Cooperative Admin Support Program at GSA, which was probably, if not the first, certainly among the first shared services programs in government, right?
Yeah, well, there probably were, in fact, there were pilot activities, you know, onesies and twosies in different parts of the country. This is the first really national effort, federal government-wide effort, to promote shared services and experiment with it.
Okay, but the CASU program was for sort of like federal executive boards, wherever there was a cluster of federal government activity geographically close, you guys set up a cooperative admin support unit to run various aspects of what was going on there. And I want to get into that because a lot of people think, again, shared services is, you know, new. And it's not, because you guys have been doing this for a while. But I want to talk in the first segment here about your roles as editors, first of Public Manager, where you were for several years after leaving the government.
Actually, probably 11 years. I started with the Public Manager. It may have even been before they changed the name from the Bureaucrat.
Back when Tom still owned it?
That's right. Well, he ran it.
Yeah.
It's a nonprofit. It's
right,
still
okay,
is.
Yeah.
And with a board of directors. Tom Novotny had reached out to me when I was a senior executive, and for about 4 years, I served as associate editor for productivity and quality improvement. So this goes back to the 80s when the federal government, following on the heels of what the private sector had been doing, got into total quality management. So we put productivity improvement and quality management together. That was also at a time when there was the President's Council on Management Improvement, which is also very much productivity-oriented. So for about 4 years, I was associate editor as a kind of a hobby, if you will, while I was a senior executive with HHS and then GSA. And when I left government, shortly thereafter, another former colleague of mine, who has just recently passed away, Paul Weiss, asked if I would be his exit strategy, because he was then editor-in-chief, and he was up to his gills and all sorts of things. So I became the editor-in-chief, promising that I would do that job pro bono for 2 years, at least 2 years. I ended up being the editor-in-chief for 11 years until last year. Also in 2004, Tom Novotny passed away, and I became the president. So I was the president and editor-in-chief of the journal for a considerable considerable period of time.
Yeah, and it went from being an independent nonprofit to being part of LMI for a while, Logistics Management Institute, and now resides under American Society for Training and Development.
Right.
The journal itself, Public Manager, formerly The Bureaucrat, is a quarterly publication for very senior executives in government. FEI graduates get it. You can certainly subscribe to it. Go to Public Manager. Is it publicmanager.org?
Yes, yeah. The publicmanager.org.
Yeah. It's a quarterly pub, but, I mean, if you want to understand the issues confronting the senior executive community, the ones that they are truly invested in, this is a great resource. So you've only recently sort of pulled back out of that?
Well, yeah, in the last couple of years, and that, you know, not to get ahead of ourselves, but that's in part because of some other things that I was drawn into at the American Society of Public Administration. But just before we get into that, I would just say that the public manager, while it's evolved, it's changed in a lot of different ways, the look and feel, et cetera, the focus has not been simply on the federal government or, for that matter, on just the senior executive. It's always been focused on the broader community of practitioners in this country and even outside. Some of the content is from different parts of the world, but mainly it focuses on a lot of those shared relationships and responsibilities that we have between federal, state, and local governments, because very few of our responsibilities are executed by just the federal government or one level of government or another, not to mention the nonprofit community, NGOs, that do a lot of the frontline work, certainly in the human services area, et cetera. So if you look at emergency and crisis management, for example, you look at first responders, yes, there are a lot of local government individuals involved, career civil servants, you know, fire, police, et cetera. But you have so many grassroots organizations that are involved, not to mention the private sector, hospitals, and others. So to me, you know, public management really is a team effort. It's a group activity increasingly. So the public manager, I think, has grasped that for decades. And while, sure, the federal government, that's where the public manager got its start, but increasingly the journal has gone outside of the Beltway and beyond the federal government for content. Most of the contributors are public servants. Over the last decade, we've drawn in a lot of content from the training community, which is why it made a lot of sense ultimately to partner with the American Society for Training and Development.
Mm-hmm.
It also made sense to partner with LMI because, you know, most of their work has been done, I mean, from its inception with the public sector, certainly the federal government, and they've been involved in consulting and training.
Okay. We're going to take our first break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about Warren's work with ASPA and Good Governance Worldwide. We're also, this is Telework Week, and we're going to talk about where Warren and I met and the CASU program and a variety of shared services that were actually pioneered in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest today is Warren Master. Warren and I have a long history. I met him when he was at GSA running the CASU program. We stayed in touch through his decade plus at the Public Manager, and you're now working with ASPA, running, actually editing, online publication, Good Governance Worldwide. This is a new one on me, Warren. Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, a couple of years ago, leadership at the American Society of Public Administration, ASPA, wanted to respond to a larger community of public management practice, a global community. And in fact, they have an annual conference in mid-March. This year's is planned for New Orleans. And an increasing number of attendees are from around the world, certainly Europe and other, you know, first world countries with their own public management or public administration associations, et cetera, many of whom are either academics or at least they're anchored in universities, but more and more we find are practitioners, whether they're leaders, you know, in their government, et cetera, in emerging democracies, developing countries, modernizing countries, and you know what they're looking for are insights, best practices, good governance practices. Most of those countries are dealing at some level, one level or another, with corruption, and you know. So how do you segue from what may have been an autocratic regime with a lot of corruption in the public sector to an emerging democracy, and then slowly but surely elevate the level of play? And one way to do that is by going to school on others who made the same journey. So ASPA had the vision that they wanted to promote good governance worldwide and do that in a more aggressive way, be more active. And so I was asked to put together a group to hammer out a strategy for that. And I did pretty much the same thing I did with the public manager, expanded a kind of advisory group, including a lot of people from around the world, including in developing countries, virtually every region of the world. And from that, a year ago this January, we put up online a website, Good Governance Worldwide, which has both original content, articles, blogs, videos, interviews, book reviews, etc., as well as, I wouldn't say, I guess borrowed would be the right term. This is content from the UN, from AID, from Harvard University, Princeton, Stanford, others around the world, the ICMA, the International City County Management Association, mm-hmm. National Governance. You'd be surprised how many of these professional organizations have international activity, most of it accessible on their website, where what I've been able to do in partnership with these organizations is provide a direct link from our website, our online journal, Good Governance Worldwide, to their site. So what I've been able to do then is kind of leverage a lot of that existing content that's been available in a kind of vertical set. They don't cut across all the other denominations, if you will, of the global community, public management community.
Okay, so you basically what you're doing is aggregating a lot of information that's germane to an international government management community.
Exactly.
Okay.
And cool. At different levels, on different topics. And, of course, we have a lot, you know, still so much of the content that we have also reaches out to ASPA's broad membership here in the United States at different levels of government.
Okay. I want to migrate into other parts of our shared past. One of the things that was going on when we first met was the initial, telework has been with us now for 20 years, right?
Yeah, actually, I, collecting my thoughts for this interview, I was... what I recalled was that, again, in the 80s, when the federal government, oddly enough, was kind of looking at a wave of retirement from the federal government, they were concerned about competing with the private sector for the best talent. So they were very concerned at that time, this is during the Reagan years, about appealing to younger, a younger and more diverse workforce, and you know, especially with more women coming in. So they looked at you know, balancing work and family and that sort of thing, and from that they got into flex time, as you'll recall.
Mm-hmm.
That started to grow in the early to mid 80s, and by the late 80s they were looking at piloting various things in the way of flex a place. They weren't quite sure what that meant back then. Again, that was a very, from a technology standpoint, it was a very different world than we have today.
Right.
So we didn't have cell phones and whatever.
VPNs.
You didn't have Androids that could get your email instantaneously. Yeah. So didn't have broadband, at least not for the, for, you know, workaday people. So the Office of Personnel Management primarily led the way in those early years, mainly in terms of policy. But in terms of activity, flex a place, for example, what has now come to be known as telecommuting or telework, was virtually non-existent. It was an idea. They were trying to set policies in place so that it was permissible. But as you know, there was a lot of resistance to that. If I don't see my employee, how can I make sure that he or she is going to be responsible?
Some things don't change.
Well, it's slow going, and it had been. I mean, the curve from the late 80s to where we are now was pretty flat. Even in the early to mid-90s, I would say, it was not all that precipitous. And then it started to take off because a lot of the number of reasons. One, the motivators, the drivers for telework started to change. You recall back in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, pollution, especially in Washington. I think Washington was second in the nation, second only to L.A.
Right.
And commuting times, the lost productivity. We were having during those years, actually going back to the 70s occasionally, we can. I don't know that we've seen it in recent years, but certainly the price at the pump has gone up. But back then, and for on a number of occasions, you recall those lines.
Oh yeah,
just to fill up your tank.
Hold that thought. We'll get to the gas lines in just a minute because I painfully remember those. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest today is Warren Master. Warren is the editor-in-chief of ASPA's Good Governance Worldwide. Is it goodgovernanceworldwide.com.org? How do you get there?
Well, yeah, it's you could Google that, just Good Governance Worldwide, and it'll give you the link. The link is aspaonline.org/global.
Okay, cool. I remember those gas lines when the oil embargo hit. We, you know, it was ridiculous. People be waiting for hours, and the lines would be a mile long.
Yeah, so think about in Washington, certainly, where most of the federal workforce was located, which, you know, was ranked second only after L.A. in terms of pollution, traffic, et cetera. Traffic congestion, and we were sprawling. You know, the District of Columbia was losing population, and the suburbs were growing. The Washington State Metropolitan Statistical Area was burgeoning. And it was not unusual for federal workers to come in from Winchester, Virginia, or Frederick, you know, Frederick, Maryland, or whatever, or south down 95. And they would spend an hour and a half to 2 hours each way, every day. Many of them in one car, one person in one car.
Yeah.
So, for all of those reasons, telecommuting was beginning to pique interest, certainly among those commuters, those federal workers who were schlepping back and forth every day, sometimes 3 or 4 hours a day. And they'd come in, and of course, they weren't very productive that first hour because they were
freaked out. Yeah.
Exactly what they were doing. And then they'd be talking about traffic, et cetera. And then, of course, about an hour before they left in the afternoon, they'd start thinking about this horrendous commute back to their home.
Getting ready to get stressed.
Yeah, so for all sorts of reasons, you know, there was a lot of consternation about the circumstances of commuting. I recall back then one of the, and I'm assuming this was not apocryphal, this was a statement that Albert Einstein actually made in 1955 that he said, commuting is the least productive or the most unproductive activity humankind makes. something along those lines. I wasn't there when he uttered that phrase, but that sentence, but someone must have picked it up. I haven't seen it on YouTube yet, but I'm sure they could recreate it. And so those were the drivers in the early days for telework. The resistance, as I mentioned earlier, was, you know, first-line supervisors, second-line supervisors. You know, they were operating under the premise that if you can't see the employee, what's to keep him or her from, you know, watching soap operas or doing anything else?
Right.
The lack of trust.
So.
And they felt that, you know, they needed to see someone perspiring. Of course, if you think about it, anyone who's supervised anyone, especially now in the last couple of decades, that the focus has been on results. That's the way you should be supervising, and then you give people as much flexibility as you can so that they can figure out how to do the work as effectively and efficiently as possible. And that's kind of that's more the modern way of supervising. Make sure that they understand what the deliverables are that they're responsible for at whatever level of granularity is necessary. And then, you know, periodically check in and see that things are going well or expect them to report back. In a sense, that's the way we manage contractors. I mean,
it's how you have to manage contractors. But, you know, then you have, you know, you deployed, and I don't know what Cassie's involvement was, but I know you had some involvement. You deployed a variety of telework centers sort of in circumference outside the Beltway, a couple in Virginia, a couple in Maryland, and then there was some agency resistance there.
Well, the telework, that's interesting because, you know, when we first started with flexible workplace arrangements, you know, the assumption was that people would maybe one day a week work from home, even though there wasn't much connectivity. But they bring stuff home with them, and that's the way they would work in the early days. And there weren't many people doing that, but the way what happened in the early 90s was we started to, at the behest of local congresspeople, congressmen and women, in the surrounding suburban areas, because they were being pushed by their base,
yeah,
people in their district, to make this more permissible. And they certainly championed telework. But how do you get over this reluctance on the part of managers, frontline managers especially, who have this picture of people at home, maybe with toddlers or infants even, or other distractions, and you can't see them. So one of the ideas was, well, how about putting together on a pilot basis a handful of telework centers in Winchester, Frederick, and other places?
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, all the area congressmen started to get interested in that. They wanted one in there.
We want district. One, too, yeah.
And yeah. So they actually uh, appro- approach GSA and encourage them to do this. And somehow or other, I think one of them got into the newspaper in the Washington Post, and there was an article, and then, of course, the genie was out of the bottle. So what we did over a period of years, we actually established 17 community-based telework centers, largely for federal workers, but they were open to others as well, because this was a partnership between the federal government and these cities or counties. Another, what happened coterminous with that is the Office of Personnel Management, through executive orders, and then also with some, over the years, some additional congressional language, either in appropriations or authorizing legislation, also promoted agencies and in some respects required agencies to move forward and increase the number of their workforce that were able to telework once a week, twice a week. We're not talking 5 days a week.
Right.
That's another misconception, even to this day. I saw just recently on PBS, they interviewed two individuals, one an advocate, one a detractor of telework. And the detractor was basically saying, well, you know, we need people to have FaceTime. Otherwise, they are, you know, we're missing out on innovation, creativity, the bonding. Well, nowhere that I know, but with very, very few exceptions, where people are working in very isolated places, does telework really imply not coming into the office at all?
Right. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're back after these messages to talk about a few other shared services that have a history. Back after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest today is Warren Master. Warren is currently the editor-in-chief of the online publication Good Governance Worldwide. You can find that at aspaonline.org. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Slash global.
All right. Again, we're talking because shared services is not a new concept. When I came, I actually came down in the middle of my honeymoon. We spent the first half of my honeymoon in Maine, second half in Charleston, South Carolina, so I could speak at a CASU conference because I was involved in direct mail at the time, and mail was one of the services that you coordinated. But another one of the services that the CASUs coordinated was print services. Outline a little bit what the CASU program did, and if tell us if it's still around.
Yeah, well, it is still around in spots, but I'll tell you how it got started in the mid '80s and the early '80s, actually, with you call the one of those Ash commissions, one of the presidential commissions, looking at how the government could work more efficiently. One of the items that surfaced in that report to President Reagan that was not implemented initially was, you know, all around the country, the federal government has installations in New York at the Javits Building downtown. There were, I think,
40-some agencies.
I think there were 50 agencies on 41 stories of the building, and each with its own set of administrative activities. There was one loading dock, but every agency had a shipping and receiving activity with a staff person responsible for it, usually a collateral duty. In fact, most of the administrative responsibilities were collateral duties. So you didn't really have an identified person with training or certification in some instances to do these things. They weren't all that well-educated, well-informed on, you know, the most efficient way to do these.
Right.
The Ash Commission recommended that the government, federal government, consolidate a lot of these administrative activities that had very little to do with the individual missions of these organizations. These were pretty much straightforward administrative activities that could be done across agency lines. So why don't you just bundle that together, et cetera? And initially, the thought within the government, including running mail services, a mailroom, for example, or procuring photocopiers or paper or whatever, shipping and moving and labor services. Those are the sorts of things that maybe GSA could do in these federal buildings. GSA certainly thought that that would be a good idea. The agencies weren't all that sanguine about GSA taking over those responsibilities, and as you can imagine, not to get into the weeds too much, but that GSA would then have to have the staff to do it, so which means they would then raid the agencies for those billets, those FTEs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can already see the kind of rice bowl contest that that sets up. And so for a number of years, there was a lot of resistance back and forth at the various management councils and government. So the President's Council on Management Improvement decided they would do something a little novel. And they set up within GSA this pilot program called the Cooperative Administrative Support Unit Program, the CASU program. And the idea being that GSA would work collaboratively in a voluntary effort with these agencies. And if you look around the country, the 800-pound gorillas, so to speak, are the IRS, the VA, the medical center, the regional office as well, the Army Corps of Engineers, Postal Service, a number of the larger agencies, the agencies that had larger number of employees in these
big footprint regionally, yeah.
Yeah, and and they worked, as you mentioned earlier, they worked pretty much through the federal executive boards, federal executive associations, federal executive councils. At the time, there were somewhere under 30 FEBs and about a similar number of FEAs, and then there were these federal executive councils as well. So those were the top leadership in the field, in regional cities or major districts, et cetera, state capitals typically. And the idea was to reach out to a handful of them and see which ones would be interested in piloting this idea of a co-op of whatever 20, 30, 40, 50 agencies in a city that would designate a lead agency, and that lead agency would be the hub for a variety of these shared services. They hadn't quite mapped out how they would go about it, but that was the general schematic, and then that's what we did. We started with a handful, Seattle, Chicago, New York City. Those were among the first. And got them up and running. And we tried to spread the lead agency role around so that no one got the sense in any other agency that, this is going to be an IRS initiative or a VA initiative or whatever.
Yeah.
It was going to be, they were going to step up to the plate, in a variety of different roles. In some place they'd be the lead, in another place they would be one of the major participants. And before you knew it, after a number of years, we had 50 CASUs around the country. I came in as a loaned executive from HHS initially to the President's Council of Management Improvement. I had my office at GSA, so I had to work with some of the GSA leadership that wasn't, especially in the Federal Supply Service, that thought that they should have the responsibility. This should not be some sort of ersatz activity run by different agencies. This was, they thought, was GSA's mission.
Right.
So it took a while, but we worked with them, and we evolved a workable relationship so that the Federal Supply Service, for example, and the Public Building Service were comfortable with what was going on.
Yeah.
Because what happened was they were able to generate significant savings. And we had an annual report. We had a board of directors that was comprised of a dozen or more, probably about 15 or 16 assistant secretaries for management or administration or whatever the appropriate term was in their organization, including the Department of Defense. As you may remember, we had Doc Cook, who was considered the mayor of the Pentagon, and he was one of the leaders, early leaders, Tom McPhee from HHS. So we had, and most of these individuals knew each other. They could make phone calls in advance out to the field, and I would sort of, I would give them the information, say, I need a contact here or there. We need someone to step up and speak on behalf of this idea, to champion it. And, you know, within a few months, we essentially figured out how to run this campaign. That's what it was. And the agencies were very helpful. And GSA was very helpful, and we all marveled, actually, at how it worked, what drove it. And before we knew it, not only did we have about 50 of these around the country, but the number of services
had expanded
to about 60.
Yeah. We're going to have to cut this short. The idea here is that the shared service concept has been around a while. It is not new. It is, again, carried over into a variety of areas. But, Warren, I do want to thank you for your time today. And, you know, we'll get together and track this bad boy into the future.
Good being with you today, Mark.
Warren, thanks a lot. You've been listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Thank you for joining us today.
You've been listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off Center, Monday afternoons at noon, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, WFED, your source for federal news now.